You're listening to the Wesley Seminary Podcast. Your host today is Dr. Aaron Perry, Associate Professor of Pastoral Theology and Leadership.
Every ministry context has its own challenges, and sometimes you get a sense of what those challenges are in the first 90 days. How do you handle the first 90 days? How do you handle a transition in ministry? What's the biggest challenge that your change in ministry has faced? Whether you've wrestled with some of these questions, or whether you're about to, or whether it's somewhere in the future that you haven't yet figured out, the change and challenge of ministry context is probably coming your way. And in the midst of that, one of the unique challenges of ministry is fundraising. The discipline of stewardship and the teaching of stewardship, the discipleship of financial resources. Today's guest, Dr. Eric Hallett, is going to talk to us about all of these things, about the challenges of ministry transition, about the opportunities facing pastors in the 21st century, and he's got a word for all pastors in the midst of this very challenging time. Dr. Hallett is the district superintendent of the Central Canada District in Ontario and Quebec, Canada, with churches reaching into the West as well. Eric is a personal friend. He is a husband to Kimberly and father of four great kids. They are not just kids. They are now adult children as well that we consider personal friends of our family too. I think that you'll find in this conversation somebody who has been through many things in ministry and has been able to find some wisdom in the midst of all of it, including how to develop a posture of faith. So thank you so much to Eric for joining us in this podcast. Eric holds a doctor of ministry from Asbury Seminary and has served in several churches in a number of different capacities. You're going to hear some experiential wisdom come through in this episode. Thanks so much for tuning in. Stay tuned for a word from our sponsor and then enjoy the podcast.
We are Wesley and you belong here.
My name is Victoria Borum and I am Wesley.
I'm Lenny Lucchetti and I am Wesley.
My name is Chris, and guess what? I am Wesley.
Hi, I'm Tina Shappett, and I am Wesley.
We recognize this beautiful diversity that the Lord has called together that is Wesley.
My name is Corey Merritt, and I am Wesley.
I am Wayne Brown, and I am Wesley.
I am Colleen Durr, and I belong here. You belong here, too, because we are Wesley.
Welcome to the Wesley Seminary Podcast, Eric. It's great to have you.
It is a joy to be here with you today, Pastor Aaron, as we know you in these parts.
You know, this is already kind of like a moment of atonement, to be honest. Got a Habs fan and a Leafs fan chatting. We got a Patriots fan / Tom Brady fan and a Steelers fan. And a lover of justice fan, which is me. So, I mean, obviously, I'd be against the Patriots and Brady. But, you know, we're still making it happen. We're still making a conversation like this work.
I wanted to take a brief moment, since you invited me here today, to let your audience know that you are more than a talking head. You are an incredibly talented pastor. You are missed, which is probably one of the best compliments that people can receive. And I want to give that to you as we work together for, I mean, close to 10 years. I can't remember you probably know the exact number of years, but the sense of what you did as a pastor, I know translates into how you serve as a professor. And then for this audience of the podcast, and I'm glad to be a member of that audience, and that you bring the experience of not only leadership, but shepherding and counseling and offering wisdom. And so I just want to thank you for the chance to be here today. You mentioned our sports teams, and I always saw us as sort of the Tom Brady and Gronk of pastoral teams. And I know for you, I'm gonna go outside my likes, and I'm gonna say, I know for you, you would have seen us more as the Roethlisberger and the Boss, and so and Jerome Bettis. So I won't say who is who, but and for those who don't in any way like sports, I hope you'll hang in on this podcast because we would be tempted to talk sports, but I'm sure that we'll get into other topics as well.
Well, man, let's just jump right in. Thank you for those kind words. And part of what you mentioned involves what I want to talk about at first is transitions. All right. I remember when my wife and I were moving from Centennial Road, where we had served together, you as the lead pastor and I was an associate. It's hard. Like, moving is hard, right? Moving is soul breaking. It tests everything. It tests every bit of order and structure you've built into your life, because you got to put down new ones, right? If you move with a family, then you might have some order and structure that translates. But boy, everything else is up for grabs, right? From the route you take to the grocery store, to where you do your banking, to who your friends are, right? Just everything is topsy-turvy. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is just that sense of transition and change. Your own ministry context has changed a number of times. You've been a staff pastor, a church planter, lead pastor of multi-staff church, and now you're a district superintendent. So you're overseeing a number of pastors and a number of churches. I would love for you just to share with us a little bit about what you felt is the biggest challenge of changing ministry contexts.
I believe that the challenge is always first with family. As you already mentioned, the family flexibility and season determines so much of what that experience is going to be like. And I was so blessed in various opportunities along the way that God would align the family season with the next opportunity. And we always looked at it as God's adventure. Hmm. And so to have that sense of this is a missional adventure. We have been wired up as a family, not only for me serving in the professional role, but we've been wired up as a family to serve Christ in particular ways. And so that's been the joy of that. But the challenge is always the biggest challenge is always family flexibility and season. And then the next challenge is you believe that you have the fit when you make the move or you decide to make the move. And sometimes you get that right. And there have been times I haven't got it right. And I would just say this about that, because there are people in your audience, I'm sure, that are contemplating, especially in the midst of a global pandemic, it causes you to reflect and to say, am I in the right place for the right season? I want to just say this, and it's probably simple, but the best decisions I have made have always been in faith. So it's always been a faith and fear. If I've made any of the decisions I made based out of fear, those didn't turn out to be the best fit. And the decisions made in faith, those were the ones that, even if they didn't look like they were a fit at first, those were the ones that always turned out the very, very best. And we've had great experiences everywhere we've served. But I would go back to the faith versus fear that, and right now, fear is pretty rampant in our society, and it bleeds into our lives as church leaders and those who serve the church or serve the academy. I would say whatever we have to do to get back into the biblical stories of faith and responding in faith is how I would just recommend, you know, for anyone that's in that season right now. And I know that's why you're doing this podcast, because people are in that contemplative season.
Let me drill down a little bit on one thing that you said, and maybe said it as not as a throwaway, but maybe it really piqued my interest. So you talked about your family seeing the leading of God as an adventure. And so every bit of it is an adventure. And certainly there's a building up of the faith of the family then, right? And families are both whole systems and they're individual persons, right? And so you might have people that are more inclined to the adventure of something that's coming one way than others. Some of them might say this is more faith, and other ones might have more fear to it, right? To put it, maybe, if not for your family, I'm sure for others. I wanted to drill down a little bit on this one, because that was a really interesting concept. There's like a family calling or ministry is what our whole family is doing. Yet now you're a dad, not just to young children that are in line with the family in your own home, but you have children who have left the home, still part of the family, left the home. So you have adult children now. How has that sense of adventure or being a family that's got a calling of God, how has that translated into how you parent your adult children and try to see them into their own adventures and starting their own families and finding the adventure that God would have for their own families?
Yeah, we're so grateful to be a part of what you and I would both, I'm sure, characterize as the Wesleyan church family. And I know you have listeners from all kinds of denominations. I feel the blessing of the greater Wesleyan church family is that we're not a large, extra large denomination. We have connections all over the place. So launching our children into the first three, you know, young adult children as IWU students, and that, I know this is not a plug for you, but I'm sure it's great for your people that you interact with. But in terms of the kids going to IWU, we've launched them into their adventure in a very safe family environment. And most of our adventures, we ventured out and did a little bit with another denomination at one point in our career. But when you have a family that is worldwide, that can launch you into adventures because of the sense that, yeah, we're doing something sometimes crazy, whether it's planting a church or whether it's moving halfway across the country. But at the same time, we know we're part of a bigger family. So when I talk about adventures, we've had adventures, but we've always been in the sense of this really wonderful sense of family within our denomination and group of people together that serve. I don't know where that's going to go in the future for us, because we are trying to become more than just family as a denomination. We are seeking to become a movement again. And, so that's going to involve change in the sense of what the adventures look like. But yeah, how we've launched our children has been in this beautiful family that God has provided protection and friendship and grace and challenge all at the same time. So I talk about being adventurous, but then we're also in a very wonderfully, the family of God, whether it's, you know, our denomination or others, it also provides that sense of the people of God are on this mission together.
Yeah, I think about even the story of Noah and the ark and this building of a structure that survives chaos and survives flood. And you've got to think about that in terms of the family. So Noah specifically is a family, but then beyond that, right, as you start to think out, you can think of, well, what structures can I create for my children in a network? What structures, how can I build strength into them through education? And then putting those together, right? What kind of environment is going to be best for their education as they are testing and exploring and discovering and all those things? And so, I mean, that again is part of the challenge of moving, right? Is that you often change networks, and we're using the tool of Zoom, right? The technology to help make this possible. But our families are not able really to be as closely connected as they once were, although we do still enjoy friendship, especially with the children who have come through Indiana Wesleyan University, and they've invested in our children, and we've enjoyed getting to see them grow up into adulthood. And so, you're right, moving has all those, it's testing all those structures, ones that are close to us. It's seeing if ones that we had maybe established over time, like in a network of a wider denomination, if those will hold, if those are really helpful. But those are all being tested. All right, I want to go back into this notion of changing ministry contexts, especially with leadership in mind. So you've identified some of the personal challenges or what you're trying to hold on to in the midst of changing ministry context, the posture of adventure, the posture of faith, and that. Maybe a little bit more nuts and bolts with this question. When you're changing contexts, what did you try to do in the first 90 days? So we often think about this time is so critical, the first 100 days, the first 90 days. If you were changing contexts, did you have anything that you were specifically trying to get done in that initial window of time? Or what wisdom would you have for somebody in that first window of time if they're in a changing context themselves?
So I'll talk about the first 90 days. Let me talk about that specifically and then maybe back up just a little bit pre-90 days. But my sense of the first 90 days is that's your develop your reputation time. You develop that reputation in those first 90 days. And I have a little saying that you under promise and you over deliver. And it doesn't mean that you have to come in and make a massive splash. That's not what I'm talking about. But when I see new staff or new pastors, what I recommend, and based on my own experience, if you can develop that reputation as someone who is going to under-promise, but not be such an under-promiser that somebody thinks you're not going to get anything done. But you do what you say you're going to do, and you actually do a little more than you said you were going to do. And you try to develop that reputation. And I try to advise every young pastor, you don't have to come in here and change the world. You don't have to be famous in the first 90 days. You simply have to develop the sense that you can be depended on. And it's so vital. It's simple, but it's vital. To back up before the 90 days and then going into the 90 days, it's vital to listen for the dominant narratives. Whatever the dominant narratives of the culture are, that's something that you have to listen for before you come when you're in that discernment phase. And then the first 90 days are still discernment phase, because no matter what you heard in the phase of making the agreement to come to a new ministry context, you heard that narrative and you heard it on the way in, but you begin to really, the narrative begins to unfold in those first 90 days. And listening for the stories and inviting people to tell their stories and just simply listening. And the more you change context, or the more, you know, the more times you do it, the better you get at just simply being able to relax. So yeah, I still want to develop my reputation. I still want to underpromise and overdeliver, but I really want to be listening, because as you know, there's a narrative to every context. And another little piece of advice: when something feels wonky in the decision phase or the discernment phase, I've learned to listen to that as well, you know, and that's the faith fear factor as well. But sometimes things are wonky and people do something and you're not grasping why. I've had so many times of changing, you know, positions. Hopefully I've done a decent job in the positions that I'm not just changing for change sakes, but that's my thing. Listening for that dominant narrative, or the two or three dominant narratives. You and I both know the church where we came in together, I was probably a month or two ahead of you in the context we served for the longest time. And the narrative at that point, as you know, wasn't all positive. The narrative was, we were great once. We've gone through a trauma, and what are we going to do now? Right. Mm. So you and I heard a lot about the past. And so with your help and the help of our team, we were able to reestablish the narrative of brighter days ahead for a group of people that at one point were quite traumatized. And so it, you know, it's just every context has those stories. So that's what I listen for. And what I want to do is establish the reputation.
Mm. That principle, do what you say you will do. I mean, that just translates across, right? And that's one of those spots that I think you can sometimes name the tension in the move, in the changing context, is especially in a church context, you're at a new church, you're at a new place where you're wanting to make a good impression. You want to do what you say you will do. And you've still got, maybe you've got a family that you're still trying to do that there. And those can be put in tension, right? Like where are you trying to succeed and thrive? And those can feel put in tension. And it definitely takes, when you underpromise, it gives you a chance to overdeliver in both of those places. And that's why it's so hard, is right. How do you, in an established place, you know where the give and take can happen. You know, in my family, I know the time that if I'm going to be away, it's easier for me to be away at this time and not at that time, right? Whether that's right. Time of the day or whether that's time of the year, I know those rhythms. But in the move, in the transition, you're still figuring those things out, figuring out for your family, figuring out where the points of sensitivity are for the church. And so I love that advice you have, is to listen. Right. Everybody everybody wants to be listened to. Right. Nobody wants to be everybody thinks whether or not they think they have something to say, they have something that they want to say. Right. Everybody wants and needs to be listened to. So I think that's really beneficial and helpful.
Yeah. Contexts and cultures, the stories are there. Hmm. If, and stories are fun. And some stories are painful and some stories are joyous. And regardless of when, you know, you and I arrived at a church that had gone through a split, and we heard a lot of traumatic stories, but we also heard a lot of stories of great moves of God, right? So it's so vital in that. The only other thing I would say about the first 90 days is to be patient, but to be looking for your who's, the who's in Whoville, you know, first who, then what, according to Jim Collins, right? And so you're looking for that team, you're looking for, but you really, it's probably better not to decide on team members in the first 90 days, unless you're pressed into a place where you've got to move fast. That's how God brought you to us, which we were so delighted that God brought all that together. And that was the Lord, and that was listening, and that was just a sense of, you know, God just moving, right, in context. So, but yeah, looking for that team that's going to carry you, you know. And so I wouldn't say if you don't have to make switches in the first 90 days, you know, try to listen hard for the first year, really, but be ready to be looking for that team that's going to complement what you bring to the table.
I want to switch gears another time here, and I want to go into one of the toughest subjects. And this is one that whenever I look back at some of the things that I learned from you or learned in the ministry context alongside you as well, and this really integrates with questions of context and the story of a church and where you're leading. And that's the subject of fundraising, right? Stewardship, and how the pastor teaches it, how the pastor engages the congregation, how the pastor is discipling the church. And this can be from a solo pastor of a house church to a lead pastor, right? There's some principles that hold true, or there's some fears that can hold true as well across these different contexts. I've recently been going through a book called A Spirituality of Fundraising by Henry Nouwen. It's published by Upper Room Books. So I've been going through this book in part because whenever I think Nouwen, I don't think fundraising, right? Those two things ought to go together. And if there are people that are often looking to Nouwen as for a theology of pastoral ministry or a theology of leadership, he's got a great book, In the Name of Jesus, on reflections on leadership. You know, not often are they thinking about, well, what do I learn from Nouwen about fundraising or about leading in terms of stewardship? But it's been a really eye-opening little book. Now, I'll get into the book in a little bit and we'll chat through. I know it's one you've read before as well. But I'd love for you to just have a chance to share about what you're learning in this season. So you're overseeing pastors, and it's been a tough time for a lot of people in church. As you're leading, as you're coaching the pastors, as you're listening to them, how can pastors today, in the midst of COVID and all of that, how can pastors talk about stewardship and fundraising in this kind of time?
The one word over the years that I think God has imprinted on me when it comes to stewardship and fundraising, the word that allows me to get out of my own head on this is counterintuitive. That sometimes I trust my intuition. I'm an intuitive person if you look at Myers-Briggs or any of these kind of things, but fundraising is often, it's counterintuitive because we think, oh, it's an imposition on someone to present the need of what's going on at the church or present the vision or the mission of what God has asked us to do. And it's been counterintuitive to me over the years because people in practice love to give. And the more they give and the more they express generosity tangibly, the more joy they experience in their life. And so once you can get onto that side of the equation, But once again, we're back into the faith fear side of things, and we're often afraid, how will I be perceived? How will we be perceived in terms of the sense of asking for funds? I grew up in a working class home and with parents who loved to give. They were incredible givers. But Canadians, and I'm sure a lot of people in the U.S., they're very private around these areas of their finances, but they still love to give. In that working class home where I grew up, when I started to venture into ministry, I was venturing out into mission trips as a teenager. that was a, I give my parents so much credit because it was a major hurdle for them to think about their son in the little small town I grew up asking for money to go on a trip. To, even if it was serving God, it all sounded so exotic to be able to go. My first mission trip was to Denver, Colorado in 1985. And to do that mission trip sounded quite, he's going to the Rockies, you know what? But, and my folks felt like they should pay for all of that. And with a great youth pastor who helped and just some, my parents were able to say, no, it's okay for others to support this because it's on behalf of God and on behalf of the church. And so the fear is often that we'll be perceived as taking from people when actually, when this is healthy and in order, people love to give to servants of Christ who are willing to lay their time, energy, and effort on the table for the sake of the mission. Now, you and I both know this can get out of alignment anywhere. Any of us can be tempted to get out of alignment, but I find more often than not, the temptation is not to even try to get in alignment. It's to try to stay on the side of, well, we won't even attempt this. But when we get into that sense of, no, we're gonna do a healthy fundraising effort, whether it's raising money for a project for the church or raising money for a missionary or raising money during COVID to help the disadvantaged, people love it. They absolutely love it. And you and I both know the joy when we give. And so I would just say, be counterintuitive and be biblical. I was reading from Exodus this morning. The priests who served, Aaron and his sons, were to have a portion of what was given. And that was the way God designed the system to work so that his work would be preeminent among the community and among the people. So I love this topic, and it's not easy for any of us to think about because it's also a very spiritual deal. And so anyway, that's kind of how it's happened for me over the years, to be willing to be counterintuitive.
Yeah, the uncomfortability factor, I think, is like you were saying about the mission trips, is asking for something that you will benefit from, right? Like, you're asking people to make a gift and you will be the beneficiary of it because you're going to have the experience of the mission trip. Now, as soon as you take a moment and you expand your scope of that, then people know it's like, well, it's not just Eric's experience in Denver, Colorado that they're giving to. In the scope of a life, it's, oh, we're starting to build the life of a teenager in faith, right? Like, and then we're seeing, oh, this was part of him being a pastor. This was part of him being in leadership in the church. So suddenly there's a sowing into the whole experience. And you realize, if you were to look at it objectively, oh, it wasn't really just about me. Yeah, I benefited from that experience in Colorado, but it was also part of the wider scope of ministry, what God has been able to do. And you can make the parallel then to the pastor talking about tithing, talking about stewardship with the church. There's this invitation to giving to the church. And yeah, the pastor benefits from it, right? The pastor draws a salary from the church, but it's also making possible the ministry of that church, right? It's making possible the ministry of that church that's going to serve the poor. It's going to serve people who need education, going to serve people who need friendship and relationship all the way along. And I like what Nauen talks about, because he keeps putting his finger on that pressure point, which is, it's accountability and it's relationship, right? There's no relationship that exists without giving, right? Every relationship that has, if it's going to be two ways, has to have measures of giving both ways.
Right.
And the pastor is not operating as the servant of people who are paying the salary, who are paying to the church, which is paying the salary. The right. Pastor's the pastor, right? There's a giving of the pastor's time. The pastor is one who is given by God, and they are seeing where to spend time appropriately in leading and caring for the church. So the pastor's giving in that sense, time at his or her discretion, even while the people are giving to God.
It is spiritual in the sense that every time that we have faced a fundraising situation, it's so spiritual in the sense that having those prayer partners that are praying you to that point, and then it's God really laying out, here's how you're going to lead this. You are going to be the first giver in this situation, right? And the most joyous times, some of the most joyous times, because there's joy in every aspect of ministry, but some of the most joyous times for me have been in those moments that it basically was saying in faith that I'm being asked by God to give this. And our last major building thrust here, you know, at the church that I served up until last year, I knew that the amount of money that God was asking for me to and our family to give was well beyond anything that was in the normal run of things with college kids getting ready to go to college. And yet God just worked miraculously through that. And it's once again, counterintuitive. God works in ways, he's beyond our ways of working. But when we're in the pattern of God's work, you understand, oh, this makes complete sense. Even though to the accountant, it doesn't make any sense. And I love going to account, you know, I've had different people that have helped with taxes over the years. And it's always fun when they look at what pastors give, because they just are baffled by how pastors are able to give what they give. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of fun to be able to be a witness that way for Christ in the community.
That name is one of the things that Nouwen talks about. So he talks about the question of money is also the question of control and who has control of one's life. And he's putting it in the context of fundraising. He says, whenever there's a person who's inviting people to give, there's an acknowledgement that this is God's organization or this is God's ministry, and that it doesn't go without the gifts of God's people, right? And so there's a way that they are in the spirituality, in the act of fundraising, they are admitting their own dependence on God, and that's a scary thing. And the person who's giving is also admitting their dependence on God, and that's a scary thing, that the mutual giving of what I have to you and what you have to me and what we both have to something that's mutually shared or that we mutually want to support is an acknowledgement that God is the one who's in control. Now, of course, whenever you get into the details of a personal life, hopefully it reflects, oh, this is a family that is seeking to serve God, right? And so then how challenging for the pastor to be like, well, is my own life lining up with what it is that I'm with what it is that I'm teaching, right? Is my own life, does it hold muster, right? Is it a life of integrity with what I'm teaching? Am I being holistic? Is my life one of integrity as well?
I love what you bring up there from now, and I love this topic in the sense of where we're going as a movement. You know, Dr. Schmidt and the DSs and the people that are directing, you know, at our schools and whatnot, we all know we're moving into a time when we are asking once again in faith, in order to become a movement, we're asking people to be co-vocational in terms of how the next wave of church plants are going to happen in North America and the wave of missional and missionary activity for Canada and the U.S., and, you know, I'm sure it's Western Europe as well, in terms of that we are going to be moving into a time when we used to ask people, will you go and work in this profession as a pastor? Well, your students and your audience and so many now, we're asking something else as well. We're asking, will you go to a place like IWU or one of our other schools? Will you train in a profession, and will you train in the profession of being the leader of a community of faith? And it's going to be so interesting to see how we do as a Wesleyan church denomination in seeing people trained up, but also asking people, saying, will you give your life to this? Will you give your life to being as my daughter is studying to be a doctor in occupational therapy, will you be a doctor in occupational therapy and also be involved in leadership of a local church? Like, will we be able to see this happen? I think this is a big ask, and it's a big consideration that we're asking people to think in new paradigms, and fundraising's a part of that, because the COVO is providing a significant amount of the funds that are going to allow that community of faith to develop, whether it's micro church, whether it's a parent daughter church situation, whatever, you know, or even parachute drop, whatever it is. So that's going to be vital, you know, moving forward for us.
Now it talks about one of the best resources that any faith-based operation has is community. And like we were saying, there is no community without giving. And finances is one of the things that we have to give. And what I've found is that people who are financially invested will also give other things. They will give their time. They will give their emotion. And let's put time and emotion together and call it prayer, right? They will give their prayers and tears for the church. And I've also found that if people are giving their time, that gets their heart, right? That can get their heartstrings as well. And yep. So out of that abundance, out of that desire for community comes the desire to give financially as well. And so I always encourage people whenever they're engaging and thinking about this is if there's a certain anxiety or nervousness that comes with talking about money is, well, just what is it that you want for the person to benefit from this community? What is it the benefit you want for them from what you're asking them to give to? And maybe it's something that actually captures their heart and their life and they're able to give their time to it and they're able to give part of their life to this organization, this community. And maybe it's a wider movement, right? You know, the people who sewed into Eric Hallett's life back when you were a teenager, maybe some of them had an idea that, oh, this is going to be part of a life that's spent in serving to God. Or if somebody is raising funds from people who are at a distance from their organization, they have to realize that there's a story they're going to be able to tell. And the person, even from a distance, is still going to be joined up with the story of what's happened. Right. So all the people that gave to teenager Eric are still part of the story that God is telling through your life. And your story has been a small component of the wider stories of the churches in which you have served, which have done ministry, right? And so that's how we kind of have this paradox of our big story is people have small roles in our big story, and our big story is just a small part of the big story of our ministries or churches or whatever else. And so that's always helped me is to think about how do I frame this in terms of community or joining up with something bigger than what the individual is.
And from the perspective that I've had the joy to be a part of this past year and a half, and especially the last year of the COVID epidemic, to watch the people of God respond in faith to just continue to give in the midst of massive upheaval. Ed Stetzer talks about consumer Christians are kind of going off to the wayside, and that is absolutely true. But thank the Lord, at least I talked to a lot of the district superintendents as well. We have seen such incredible faithfulness of the core people of the Wesleyan Church. We, as GS, Dr. Schmidt, and then DSs, we were all anticipating massive budget cuts just a year ago. And we just anticipated it, and they didn't. We've had trimmings here and there, but really people have responded in faith. That doesn't mean we won't face tougher times and difference, but our people as a core of Wesleyans, they truly believe in this message of transformation, this message of hope and holiness. They believe in their leadership. They believe in their institutions. Our institutions aren't perfect, but people believe in the God that has called us. So now our next challenge is to be able to celebrate people, to stay on the faith side, and now to look forward and to say, okay, God, how do you want to challenge us in terms of what are you asking us of us in terms of the mission now to reach a society that is that has been transformed from what could have been considered a somewhat Christian dominant society to now a very secular kind of North American society. And so I'm excited for that. I'm excited that we can ask people to give just in the spirit of how Nouwen is talking about it, in this sense that we're on this adventure of God together, the people of God, you know, that have been giving since Bible times. We're that people. We are the prophets. We are the priestly community now. So it's a beautiful deal. And so I just appreciate the chance to even reflect and to say thank you to those in your audience who have been so faithful. And even when it was tough to give, they've done it. And it's beautiful.
I'm thinking about how that description of we are the generation of, or we are the descendants of a people of faith, and how far back that stretches, and how I think that is a much better story. I think that is a much better way of framing our identity than something that says we are the generation we've been waiting for, right? That how we take our identity and our heritage from people of faith who have gone before us is so different from how we see ourselves as the pinnacle of people who have never quite gotten it right, but we do. And that is certainly one that's a narrative of our popular culture, right? That we are much better, much more in tune, much more knowledgeable, much more aware of what's going on and our morality. Now, I don't want to get into that. It's a whole different podcast. So that's just me testing something out there, throwing it out into the ether and seeing. But I think maybe there's something there. Here's the last question I want to ask. We're going to wrap things up with this. You're a superintendent now. I would love for you just to talk to pastors. Okay. What would you want every pastor under your care to know? What would you say that every superintendent should be saying to their pastors on a regular basis?
The beautiful part of our movement, and the movement that we are seeking to be faithful in response to God to see happen, the beautiful part is I am in contact with DSs all the time. And I'm so grateful because I get to hear their perspectives on their districts. I'm still pretty much a rookie. I'm considering myself a rookie DS, but what I'm observing from our district superintendents in terms of relating to pastors, it's this sense of affirmation, the sense that, you know, this journey does bring a lot of twists and turns. It brings a lot of challenges. It challenges us at the deepest parts of ourselves in terms of our response to God when we are sometimes leading people that are in so much pain that they strike out at their shepherds. And to just be able to say to pastors, you know, we are in this long story, as you mentioned, we can be abundant, and you are loved. And that's the, you know, as you know, Dr. Perry, Aaron, you know this, in terms of the people you have led, it's that sense people want to know, does my leader love me? Am I loved? Am I valued? And the thing is about being a professor or a district superintendent or a pastor, you can't do anything unless other people are doing their part. And pastors make a DS. DS, ultimately, it's the pastors of a district who make a DS. Right? If a DS develops a reputation, it's because of the pastors and what they did. And sure, the DS plays a role in that. But ultimately, we're going to be the sum total of the people who serve and the people who are sacrificing and giving their life and effort and energy. And so, you know, I want the pastors that serve with me, I want to be able to have what they're calling crucial conversations. Because not everybody fits everywhere all the time. And sometimes you have to have a conversation that says, hey, it's time to get a new coach for this team, right? That's not easy. But I would want, even when I have to have those kind of conversations, I want the pastor to know that she or he is loved and that God has their best interests in mind. And they, what they gave in their first part of their call, that they can continue to give that all the way through, you know, to their 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and God is with them. So that's what we're experiencing. That's what I'm watching other DSs just provide, that affirmation and permission and the sense that, you know, we're in the adventure together.
Eric, thanks so much for taking the time to join us at the Wesley Seminary podcast today.
Thank you so much, Aaron. It's been a privilege.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Thanks for making this conversation possible. As Dr. Hallett said, it's the pastors who make a DS and it's the listeners who make a podcast. What you say about the podcast is what the reputation of it is. And we hope it's one that's valuable to you. We hope it's providing and discussing topics and resources for fruitful ministry. And we hope that if you do like these topics, if you do find them helpful, that you will like and subscribe. Let other people know about the seminary podcast. Thank you, Cam, for your production work, helping to have things run smoothly here at the podcast. Always appreciate working alongside you. Eric, again, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today with from your experience and with some of the things that you have learned along the life spent in ministry. We certainly appreciate it. I'll trust all of you to have a great day.
Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the name Wesley Seminary.